Welcome to 30 Brave Minutes, a podcast of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. In 30 Brave Minutes, we'll give you something interesting to think about. Joining the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, Jeff Frederick, are Jay Blauser, Director of Campus Sustainability, Nathan Phillippe, Senior Lecturer in Geography, Andy Ash, Professor from the Department of Biology, and Rachel Smith, Professor of Chemistry. Their topic, sustainability.
One of the words that has crawled deeper into our daily lexicon in the last decade is sustainability. Sustainable agriculture, sustainable architecture, sustainable and renewable energy, carbon footprint reduction strategies, sustainable ecosystems, environmental and ecological impact studies, clean air and water, sustainable business practices, a sustainable global society. In its depth, sustainability integrates social sciences and environmental science and history with numerous physical and natural sciences, engineering, and certainly technological applications. It's a changing intellectual discipline and an important contemporary issue. Our children and their children will inherit the world we leave for them. We better leave them something sustainable. It's also a practical matter. How do you manage wetlands? What about various species in decline? How do you arrest deforestation? What about building neighborhoods that are energy efficient, economically resilient, and able to endure the human and environmental factors of a rapidly changing world? Across the world today, over a billion people lack access to electricity. How will we produce and distribute electrical current so that light and heat and cooling and refrigeration and medicine and internet can blanket the earth? In addition to upgrading the quality of life and extending the duration of life, delivering electricity to the world would create a huge number of jobs and bring tangible economic and educational benefits across underdeveloped areas. In some ways, progress on sustainability has been halting. Henry Ford's Model T, introduced about 100 years ago or so, got 25 miles to the gallon. The average full-size SUV today gets about 20. Admittedly, the truck I drove to campus today, 17. Last year, our electricity came primarily from these sources. Natural gas, about 34%. Coal, about 30%. Nuclear, around 20. And renewables, around 15. Even so, the number of workers in solar has doubled since 2012 to around 260,000. And the total amount of solar energy capacity increased nearly 50% last year alone. Sustainability, then, has a significant economic impact, but it also has a practical impact. By 2050, the world's population will be about 9 billion, and that will necessitate a massive increase in the amount of available food. Already, 51% of the world's population lives on about 2% of the planet. Let's think just about the food issues alone, although clearly there will be other related issues of energy, architecture, living space, and dozens of other concerns if the population gets to 9 billion. All right, let's work on food. Easy enough. Let's add some more land under cultivation and increase the amount of fertilizer so we increase the yield. Except that affects the water supply, and some land will need to be allocated for living space for all the additional people. Well, let's just increase the animal supply through systematic breeding. Except more livestock can produce more emissions, which causes other problems. All right, let's just expand genetically modified crops to fill the void. Great! Except those foods might have a detrimental effect on your health. The long and short of sustainability is that it's sort of perfectly Newtonian. Newton's third law, crudely stated, suggests that for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Every time maybe you fix some element related to sustainability, you might unleash another set of forces at the same time that growth and changes in organic beings are already taking place and are affected by. And these issues are creating global, national, corporate, and community impact. A growing number of firms are now listing water scarcity as an issue that could change profitability along with the way they do business. So, many different matters have an impact on sustainability. Air conditioning, for example, makes a clear and noted improvement in our lives. Who would disagree with that as we sweat uncontrollably doing this broadcast in August in the South? A recent study concluded that the world consumes about 1 trillion kilowatt hours of electricity for AC annually. more than twice the total energy consumption of Africa for all of its purposes. It's also estimated that energy for cooling would increase tenfold by 2050 if we get those 9 billion people. At what price, then, would our comfort come? Our topic today, sustainability, a matter of critical importance with each passing year. Joining us are Rachel Smith, Nathan Philippi, Jay Blauser, and Andy Ash. Well, let's start by saying, from the most basic perspective, how each of your disciplines and areas of specialization define sustainability.
Within the area of the chemical industry and the pharmaceutical industry, we really refer to sustainable chemistry as green chemistry. And the emphasis is on trying to decrease the total amount of waste products that are produced, particularly hazardous waste, make the most efficient yield of the starting materials that we use in order to make pharmaceuticals and other products. And we're also trying to increase the efficiency of, for instance, heating methods, more direct heating methods, for instance, microwave heating, where you're not actually heating a material that is then used to heat the chemicals undergoing the reaction, but more directly heating them. So those kinds of emphases are what the chemical industry is trying to do in order to be more responsible about the way that we're producing chemicals in today's environment.
How about the rest of y'all?
Within geography, we emphasize the idea of human environmental impacts and what is the role of humans and their responsibility towards the environment and the idea of stewardship, particularly with the idea of land use change and land use development and mapping out these processes and trying to create a more realistic picture and idea of how the land and resources are being used so we can come to a better understanding of using scarce resources and hopefully keeping them around longer for future generations.
That reminds me, I went camping a couple weeks ago, and when I checked in with the ranger, the last thing she said to me was something I've heard many times, leave no trace, right? Whenever you're done, make it like you weren't even here.
Ecologically, I think sustainability amounts to two things. First, keeping the human requirement for biosphere resources below the ability of the biosphere to provide those resources. And secondly, human extraction of resources should not impair the structure or function of natural systems such that they cannot provide those resources.
So in some sense, it's a math problem. What's the capacity and how do we stay under it?
It's a math problem and a structural problem. If you compare, for instance, an agricultural field with a natural community, the difference in the number of species is obvious, and that structure provides stability. At least that's what ecological theory says. And so when we modify natural systems to human use, we usually diminish structure, which then impairs stability and longevity. So, you know, there are problems more than just math. It's configuration and resilience.
Jay, talk about it from your perspective.
Sure. All of this is in line with the way our committee here on campus, the Sustainability Council, defines. We actually endorse the Environmental Protection Agency's definition, as well as the Association for the Advancement of Sustainability in Higher Educations. Basically, and it's exactly what's already been said, but it's based on a simple principle. Everything that we need for our survival and well-being depends either directly or indirectly on our natural environment. Therefore, sustainability creates and maintains the conditions under which humans and nature can exist in productive harmony that permit fulfilling the social, economic, and other requirements of present and future generations. That's the EPA's version.
And that's a mouthful.
It is. A shorter version that we also agree with is that from ASHI. They define sustainability as in an inclusive way, encompassing human and ecological health, social justice, secure livelihoods, and a better world for all generations.
All right, so let's talk a little bit maybe about the last decade where it appears, at least from a layman's perspective, there's been a lot of energy released about the issue of sustainability and attacking it. In what ways have we made progress over the last decade or so in terms of understanding sustainability and taking some action toward making a more sustainable world?
A lot of people have recognized that cutting carbon emissions has been one of the most important aspects of environmental sustainability. On top of that, there's the idea of urban growth sustainability within development. As cities become larger and the majority of the population of the world starts moving into urban centers, where can these people be placed in not only in a sustainable way so they don't impact or have a negative impact on the environment, but how can they live comfortably? How can they sustain a way of life that is good? Be able to make a living that gives them respect and doesn't degrade themselves in any way, and have a shelter that is safe and solid, right? So in the respects of developing countries, a lot of governments are starting to step forward, particularly within Asia, to be more prudent about, particularly again about carbon use and cutting the carbon footprint, by not allowing automobiles into the downtown urban centers, but forcing them to be mass transit in general, or even in Europe where this is also, there's been a huge push for this, but then also pushing for more green, not areas in general, but green buildings where they will put plants on the rooftops or plant more trees within the boulevards and or use interchange areas to offset the carbon footprint of vehicles.
And Jay, we've been doing some of that on our own campus, right?
Oh, absolutely. We incorporate those technologies in our projects where it's feasible and practical. But to piggyback off of what Nathan was saying, what also is encouraging to me on a global scale is where the United Nations is coming together. We have many countries in the world that are coming together and have been for many years. I mean, I guess it started way back in 92, I guess, with the Rio Earth Summit. But since then, you had the Kyoto Protocol, and most recently, now you've got the Paris Agreement, which actually went into effect back in November 2016, which is now encouraging because a lot of countries in our world are actually working on trying to reduce these and mitigate these issues that are causing all this climate change.
Well, let's break it down one step further. Why are carbon emissions at an excess volume bad for the environment, bad for the globe in such way, or how significant is the problem?
Carbon dioxide is greenhouse gas, and it absorbs infrared radiation, which is a form of heat. So the more CO2 is in the atmosphere, the warmer the atmosphere gets. And we are on track to have, for the fourth decade in a row, the warmest decade in which people have kept records. So there are a lot of aspects to it, but I think the bottom line is, if there's something we can do about that, we ought to, regardless of who caused the problem, for starters. The analogy I use in my ecology class is if you're going down a hill and your brakes fail in your car and you're about to go over the edge, does it really matter whether somebody did that to you or your car just failed? And I think we pursue the wrong argument in a lot of cases. We worry too much about how much of this is caused by human beings, how much global warming due to excess carbon in the atmosphere is caused by people. The simple fact of the matter is, if carbon concentrations are going up, we need to figure out strategies to reduce them and not get bound up in these arguments about whose fault it is or why it happened.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, focusing on blame doesn't do much to address the problem. It just sort of isolates one group or another. What about in the chemical industry? What sort of progress has been made in the last decade there?
So I'd say one of the main ways in which we've progressed, at least in our emphasis and our strategy for making our processes more sustainable, is trying to use fewer solvents that are volatile organic compounds and increasing the number of reactions that can be performed in water rather than a toxic solvent. And There was a Nobel Prize given in 2005 to a team that developed a catalyst that is able to do a reaction that was previously a very toxic reaction and can now be done under much more green conditions. So there is a renewed emphasis, a greater emphasis on even in the pedagogical sense. Even in the labs, we do our experiments on smaller scales so that we're producing fewer waste products. But at every level, we are really trying to decrease the amount of waste that we're generating.
Because that waste is not easily disposed of.
Exactly. So even here at the university, we have to pay a company to come and take away all of the waste products from all of our reactions that we do here. And the same is true, but even to a greater scale, for those chemical manufacturers.
Well, that's all very optimistic. Some progress here or there. Let's flip the side of the coin to the other viewpoint. What are our challenges? What are the areas where we haven't made as much progress? Where are the places where sustainability needs to become a bigger emphasis?
From an ecological point of view, I think one great area where we could work harder is in an area that's called ecosystem services. That is, assigning value to functions that natural systems provide that have in past business models not been taken into account. For instance, if we had to build machines to supply oxygen to the atmosphere, which green plants do for free, how much would it cost? It would break the budget of every nation on Earth. First of all, we don't have machines that could work at that capacity. But we don't assign value to that, and it's a critically important function. And historically, political and economic systems have not done a very good job of assigning value to these functions that natural systems provide us for free. So when we talk about taking out 10 acres of land for a Walmart and a parking lot, that's all good. There are jobs created. There's stimulus to the local economy. But there's no factoring in of what we've lost in terms of the services that natural community was there provided to us. And I think we've got a lot of work to do in that area.
It goes back to what you were saying earlier. There's this reaction. You know, every time you make some alteration of the ecology of an area, there's a consequence, even if it's not immediately identifiable in the minds of an ordinary person.
And there are consequences that don't get factored into the economic system. In a lot of ways, economics has been based in many cases on acquiring natural resources cheaply and then selling them at a higher price to somebody else or transporting them somewhere. I mean, that's where a lot of the very wealthy people came from. There is not a good connection between ecological principles and economic principles.
We'll return to 30 Brave Minutes in a moment, but first, thank you for listening and for your financial support of the College of Arts and Sciences. Please consider a contribution to the Arts and Sciences Dean's Fund. The fund exists to help students and faculty make meaningful connections to the community, the state, and beyond through intellectual inquiry, scholarships, and research in the humanities, social sciences, and STEM fields. Consider a contribution today. Mark your envelope the Dean's Fund, College of Arts and Sciences, UNCP, Hickory Hall, Pembroke, North Carolina, 28372, or call the College of Arts and Sciences at 910-521-6198. You can also find us on the web. And now, back to 30 Brave Minutes and your host, Jeff Frederick.
What about other challenges, other ways in which, you know, sustainability is still kind of in its infancy?
Culturally, the idea of the foods that are consumed and that demonstrate wealth or success. For instance, Western countries have largely banned wheat and meat-based types of diets, and so as these developing countries that were largely based off of vegetarian diet shift to show that they've been successful, that puts more stress not only on the byproducts that these animals create, which may or do have an effect on climate change, but also on the economies. What is the cost for meats and chickens now? And not only that, but the taboos that are put into place for what is consumed even of these animals. Even going back 50 years ago, there was much more parts of the animals that were consumed on a regular basis or would show up on a table, like the tongue or the kidneys or the sweetmeats or whatnot, as something that could just be consumed and was affordable to lower-income families and whatnot, whereas today it's very difficult to find any of those products, and people make icky faces when thinking about that. And one of the things that, particularly in the Western world, as populations do increase and a lot of these food types become scarce, maybe the idea of how we approach how other countries do eat different types of tubers or vegetables or even bugs might be something that should be embraced just to stretch out and make consumption of foods more affordable and available.
Other challenges?
I think in terms of energy production, that's a large industry and a large area that is contributing to some of our climate change. We have a lot of technologies that are in development currently with solar and wind turbines and different things. The issue that is sort of limiting, one of the main issues that's kind of limiting us from really, you know, hitting passing here with these technologies is the intermittency of the technology and the capacity to be able to store that energy. You know, as long as the wind's blowing and the sun's shining, you know, you're producing power. But what happens at night when the wind's not blowing? That ability to capture that when it's produced, store it, and then use it when it's at night or the wind's not blowing, that's the area that we're still improving. During the process, while this is improving, there's going to be some intermittent technologies and sources of power. I know, you know, coal is sort of losing its focus, and that intermittent fuel is currently natural gas. There's pros and cons with that as well, but during this period of development, until the intermittency is worked out with our technology, we're going to have to, you know, do a little give and take, I guess is a good way to put it.
So we're okay at producing renewable energy, maybe even distributing it, but storing it and keeping some excess is a place where we need to make some progress.
Absolutely.
Well, let's talk just a little bit about the science. There are some that are skeptical about matters related to sustainability. How clear is the science on sustainability and its relationship to all of us?
Well, I think if you go back to basics, the science is pretty clear. There's a finite amount of mass on the planet, and the mass of the human population is not going to exceed the mass of the planet at some point. There will be limits to growth at some point, okay? So if you're going to have a sustainable society, you're going to have to recognize that where those limits are and how do we keep the human population below that limit. And another thing, we sort of danced around this a little bit, but you know what? Sustainability has a subjective component to it. You can live sustainably at all sorts of different levels depending on what your ecological footprint or your requirements from the environment are. And sort of the universal conception is that industrialized society is where we ought to be. But we maximize use of resources, and there are lots of other societies on Earth that live sustainably at much lower levels of energy and resource use than we do. So the question is, where's the balance? And I think the science and even the leadership, political leadership on those sorts of questions has a long way to go. So the generalities, I think, are clear. The specifics, I think we've got a long, long way to go.
Well, to that end, what's the next area of research, or what's the next breakthrough that is likely to come in each of your different disciplines?
So I think Jay already mentioned the major breakthrough that really needs to happen in chemistry, which has to do with batteries and finding batteries that can hold a charge for longer. So obviously think about your electric car, right? If we are now limited how far you can drive just by the batteries. And so if we could have more efficient batteries, then we could overcome that problem.
And the market for a battery that would charge faster and last longer for virtually any device that you would use has got to be unlimited, right? I mean, we are still limited in some sense by a different kind of cord, the cord that we have to plug in to charge the battery. What about other breakthroughs that y'all would anticipate?
There was a paper that was just put out. It was being able to visualize and to create a real representation without necessarily using satellite imagery of an area or region that would be used for some form of farming. The article was specifically talking about bioenergy plants, like sweet potatoes and things like that, that would be used with for bioenergy, and what would be its impact on the environment. But what the interest of it was is it was trying to predict, without actually having that planted, that this is the impact that we would see within this area. So
sort of predictive analytics on sustainability issues.
Yeah, so without having to go through the process and seeing, ooh, this was bad, how can we go back and fix this now? Try to predict that, gee, if we do these crops within this area, this is the type of effect that it will have on.
In some sense, there's been this reality for a century or so about urban planning, right? We have to make our cities work and lay them out in a grid and make sure things are connected. And we've also had varying levels of rural planning, right? Crop rotation, how do we maximize yield? You know, what kind of crops can replenish the soil? How do we make sure that there's an environment for livestock? But we're at the point now with sustainability where we have to integrate urban and rural planning together into a more of a network of how a holistic approach would function for everybody's benefit. And I think that's kind of an area that more and more people are beginning to study, as opposed to we have an urban area and we have a rural area and they don't connect. Kind of realizing the point where they have to connect at this point.
Exactly. And I think we touched on this earlier, but both food, availability of food, and also water are going to become more of a focus as we continue moving forward with more people on the planet and less farmers, less land to produce crops. We're going to have to develop better ways to be able to meet the demand of the food we're going to need, as well as the water, both. So those are going to become more critical as we move along.
Well, let's break it down even to a more basic level. What are common sense, easy to adopt habits and strategies that ordinary people can employ to make their own communities, their own neighborhoods a little more sustainable?
Small behavioral changes make a difference. For example, it's just your daily habits and the decisions you make. For example, take our campus here and our student population, for example. Do I drive from parking lot A to my next class, or do I just walk to my next class? I mean, it's so simple. When I'm done with this, do I recycle it or do I throw it in the trash? If you throw it in the trash, that goes to the landfill. I mean, just all that adds up. You know, do I have to use plastic bags every time I go to a store? Can I just use the same bag over and over and over? Or turning off lights? It's so many little things. It seemed like almost no-brainers, but it adds up. It's just on our campus alone, we've got 6,500 students and almost 1,000 employees. And if everybody thinks about it that way, if, you know, the simple things that you can control day to day, it makes an impact.
In urban areas, I think we've made real progress with green belts and green belt organization, park systems, and so I think that helps. But I think it's important to note here that much of what we're saying here is what sorts of human systems can we develop that work better? And one of the big mistakes that people make, or many people make, is that thinking that food comes from a grocery store or gas comes from a pump. And virtually all the material, there's almost nothing in New York City that helps New York City work the way it does. All the resources, the concrete, the wood, the food, the gas, whatever, it comes from somewhere else on Earth and often from natural or quasi-natural systems that provide those things. And so it's not just a matter of organizing and running our human-based systems better. We're going to have to ultimately be concerned about how much natural area is left to provide the resources that we all want to see in our lives and maintaining those. And it gets harder and harder to convince people of that because in, I think it was 2007, for the first time in history, over half of the human population lived in cities or urban environments. So it gets harder and harder to educate people about natural systems when most of us don't live in those sorts of systems.
Hmm. Fascinating. What do you all see, sort of finally as a wrap-up, what do you see from your students when issues of sustainability come up in discussions or in lectures? Do they seem to be a little bit more attuned to the topic, or are they just like the rest of us, they need to be brought along?
I get the sense that our students, in the same sense that they're sort of digital natives, I think they're also sustainability natives, that they don't remember a time when these issues weren't discussed. If they have the energy to walk the two extra feet to recycle their soda bottle or not, that might be a different conversation. But they are certainly aware of these issues and are having these discussions, and it is not a new topic for them. They are discussing them amongst themselves about issues of environmental awareness and sustainability.
Yeah, the students are much more aware than you and I am now, I hate to admit it, about being sustainable within their daily lives. I often ask them questions about things that they might do, such as brushing their teeth. How many of you keep the water running while you brush your teeth? And very few of them do. And I'll freely admit, well, that's something that I do just because that's what I grew up doing. Or I notice many students will, instead of buying bottled water, will have water bottles just so they don't have the impact of needing to recycle or throw that bottle out.
Some of the little things that Jay was talking about, you know, the little things add up and they become big things.
Right. And I interact from time to time with a student group called the Greener Coalition here on our campus. That's a student club that is promoting sustainability and doing various events and outreach and whatnot. And most of them are very passionate about local food, so sustainable food, local food, and so much so that they have partnered with our Student Government Association. And over the summer, they drafted a resolution where they're scheduling now to meet ultimately with our chancellor to discuss it. But ultimately what they're wanting to do is have our chancellor commit to what's called the Real Food Commitment. And what that means is basically by the year 2020, from the time you sign it, but by the year 2020, 20% of the food that you're serving on your campus dining is what's considered real food. Real food being sustainably produced food, meaning it's local, the people involved with it were paid a fair wage, it's organic or is close to free of chemicals and man-made chemicals and things that we don't necessarily want to put in our bodies. Those kind of things. If it was a protein, was it humanely produced? That's what the definition of real food is. But 20% of the food that we're buying and consuming will be that type. So that's encouraging. That's our students.
Well, congratulations to our students, and thank you to our panel for a great discussion on a really important topic. If you've enjoyed this, pass along 30 Brave Minutes to a friend, and we'll see you next time for another thoughtful discussion on a topic of interest.
Today's podcast was produced by Richard Gay and transcribed by Janet Gentis. Theme music created by Riley Morton. This content is copyrighted by the University of North Carolina at Pembroke, UNCP, and the College of Arts and Sciences. It is to be used for educational and non-commercial purposes only, and is not to be changed, altered, or used for any commercial endeavor without the express written permission of authorized representatives of UNCP. The views and opinions expressed by any individuals during the course of these discussions are their own and do not necessarily represent the views, opinions, and positions of UNCP or any of its subsidiary programs, schools, departments, and divisions. While reasonable efforts have been made to ensure that information discussed is current and accurate at the time of release, neither UNCP nor any individual presenting material makes any warranty that information presented in the original recording has remained accurate due to advances in research, technology, or industry standards. Thanks for listening to 30 Brave Minutes, and go Braves!
Great job, everybody. Y'all did great.